Welcome to Mission 150, the podcast that tells stories from 150 years of Seventh-day Adventist mission to the world. To find out more about the mission of the Adventist Church today, go to AdventistMission.org. That's AdventistMission.org.
Welcome to today's episode. I'm Sam Nevis.
And I'm David Trim, and we're delighted to have you with us again. In this episode, Sam, we're going to be talking about what might seem to be, on the face of it, a very boring topic, bureaucracy.
Okay, so we're going to peel the curtain about what sends, about the process of sending a missionary and sustaining them while they're there.
Right, because we're not just talking about the general church bureaucracy, we're talking about the particular bureaucracy, one might term it the administrative infrastructure, if one wanted to be fancy, that allowed the church to administer its foreign missionary enterprise. For successful worldwide mission by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, bureaucracy was essential. We often don't think about that. You know, we love the stories of heroic missionaries going, cutting their way through the jungles to reach unreached peoples, or journeying months through China to get to the extreme southwest of the country, away from the ports where the Europeans were present. Or whatever it may be. We love these stories of heroic missionaries risking their lives against illness and sometimes against people who wish them ill. We love these stories, but we never then ask the question, how did those missionaries get there? How did that missionary end up in the wilds of the jungle in South America or Africa?
Yeah, that will include it needs to include a sophisticated process for recruitment, vetting, and sending, the actual sending,
yes,
the sponsoring, if it is sponsored by the church or otherwise, at least the church needs to know that there is a sponsorship in place. How, yes, will they sustain there? What happens when they come back? It's complex.
You've put your finger on it. All those things have to take place. If you don't have those things, then you don't have the missionary at the front end. The missionary at the front end is supported by a huge process that's in the back end that we never talk about.
Or worse, they get to the front end and they spend all their time outside of mission focus because they're worried about all these things and they need to sort out all these things that they did not know before they arrived.
Yes.
And once they get there, there is such complexity to handle that they spend a good portion of their time taking care of those instead of being involved in mission.
Right. They get far too concerned with logistics.
Right.
And of course, you do have to have, part of this story is having people on the ground who take care of finances and logistics. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you need mission treasurers as well. But today we're going to be talking about the missionary sending and maintaining administrative infrastructure of the Seventh-day Adventist Church that historically has been located in the General Conference Secretariat. Now, secretariat wasn't a term that was used for the staff who worked under the secretary until the 1930s. Oh. Secretariat, that in the early 20th century, is a French word and it hasn't really achieved much currency in English. By the mid-1930s, the secretary's team is being referred to as the secretariat. But though the term doesn't come in before then, the secretary has a staff who work under him to direct and administer mission from the very beginning of the 20th century.
When you start a company in the United States, we don't have the fancy terms that have been created recently. You have a president, you have a secretary, and perhaps a treasurer. In Britain, there are other necessities for starting a company. Did we use the term secretary before, as far as you know, before we incorporated as in the early 1860s?
Yes, but only for one-off conferences. So for what they call the general conference at which they start to explore creating administrative structure, something we talked about right back at the beginning.
A few episodes ago.
Yeah, right back at the beginning. Each conference would have a secretary who was responsible for taking the records.
Okay.
But because there is no permanent organization, only in 1863 do you get a secretary. But from 1863, from the very first general conference session in May of 63, you have three offices, a president, a secretary, and a treasurer.
Which we still do today.
Yes.
But mission is assigned to be the role of the secretary.
Yes.
Not in the 30s, but early on. In the 30s, we just acknowledge the term secretariat.
That's correct.
I see.
The GC secretary hasn't always been in charge of mission. The secretary's first role was to take minutes of general conference sessions, to gather statistics for the different conferences and present an annual report to the GC session, which back then was annual. And his role was to correspond with conferences on behalf of the president and the executive committee.
But what size are we talking about here?
Well, so we're talking when the church is founded, about six conferences and about 3,500 members. So six conferences, 3,000 to 3,500 members. So there's very little really for an administration to do. By 1883, you're getting many more conferences. And by the early 1890s, you've got more than 30 conferences, including ones in Australia, Europe, and Africa, mm-hmm. South Africa. Mm-hmm. So things are immediately getting much more complicated. And if you want to have more missionaries go, then you need to have some kind of responsibility for that. However, it's true that in the early days, the secretary corresponded with foreign missionaries. That was part of his role as handling correspondence for the three officers and the executive committee. But in 1887, the church established a position called the Foreign Mission Secretary. Mm. And he was then charged with keeping in touch with missionaries. And 2 years later, in 1889, the church created the Foreign Mission Board. We talked about that a few episodes ago.
That it was separate from...
It was separate.
A separate from, legal entity.
Yes, yes. And so the Foreign Mission Secretary became the Secretary of the Foreign Mission Board. And so the Secretary was responsible for keeping in contact with missionaries. But as we discussed those few episodes ago, in 1903, the Foreign Mission Board was subsumed by the General Conference Executive Committee. So it was no longer a separate body. It was the General Conference Executive Committee. And as we also discussed, the president elected in 1901, Arthur G. Daniels, in 1903 arranged the election of William A. Spicer as secretary. Now, Spicer had been the secretary of the Foreign Mission Board. So maybe partly for that reason, and partly no doubt because Daniels knew that Spicer was a passionate proponent of mission, as Daniels was himself, of course. So Daniels gives Spicer responsibility for keeping in contact with missionaries. But from that, a whole lot of other things flow.
And by then, we've moved to Tacoma Park, is that correct?
Very soon afterwards.
Okay.
1904.
Right.
We begin the move to Tacoma Park. Just to give an overview of further developments that we can then go into more detail about, as the number of missionaries began to increase, which happened because they'd elected three mission-focused GC officers and restructured the church to make mission more possible. So as the number of missionaries increase, the secretary and his department were given responsibilities not only for corresponding with missionaries, but for the paperwork associated with getting missionaries into the field. And then, naturally, the secretary and his team were given responsibility for managing the missionary enterprise. You know, it follows logically. From recruiting them to their permanent return to the homeland. So right for that whole gamut, from recruiting them to arranging their permanent return to their homeland, assuming that they survive. And logically flowing from that, the secretariat was assigned the task of planning for missions and promoting missions. So one result of having a body at the world headquarters that was focused on missionaries was that the number of missionaries going overseas every year dramatically increased and, on the whole, kept increasing.
That was a phase of massive expansion.
Yes.
So if I see this, if we put it all together in a cohesive thought, I'd say, we sent our first missionary in 1873.
74.
Then there is an explosion of missionaries going to different places.
It's a modest explosion.
Okay. It's a gradual increase.
There is an increase.
Because we covered so many stories, it feels right. Like there were many.
As we touched on, Andrews could have been the first and the last.
Okay.
But instead, because people discovered it, the church leaders discovered this is more difficult and expensive than we thought.
Mm.
And you could imagine a scenario where they say, okay, we got this wrong, we'll pull our horns back in and maybe not do foreign mission again for a few decades until the church is larger. But no, Andrews is just the first. But the numbers are relatively small up to 1901. We don't know how many missionaries the church had in service in 1901, but we do have a figure for 1897, when there were 148 Seventh-day Adventist missionaries around the world.
There were, which means that some had returned already.
Yes, exactly. Or like Andrews had died, and some of the other people we talked about in the 1890s.
Died also.
There were people who died, there were people who'd gone and come back, and these people haven't all gone out at one time. They've gone out in over a number of years in some cases.
So would it be safe to assume that by, let's say, within 10 years of Spicer being elected, what you just described, we've sent hundreds of missionaries at that point?
That's exactly what happened. So remember, 1897, 148 Adventist missionaries. By 1908, there were 140 new missionaries sent out just that year, in 1908.
I see.
The previous years, starting in 1901, they averaged 50 a year, but then they beef it up so from 148 all told to 140 just in 1 year.
In 1 year. So this growth of, this is what we need to do. We don't know how to do it. So let's start.
Right.
So they start, they send missionaries, they learn with their own mistakes. But now there is a process that is needed.
Right.
And that process is now started to be implemented, which highly increases
absolutely
the entire enterprise.
So, you know, they said they sent out 140 in 1908. That wasn't an outlier, because they sent 138 the following year.
Mm.
And in 1913, for the first time, the number of new missionaries sailing for mission fields exceeded 150. So missionaries, now we're seeing an explosion, Sam, no question.
I see.
In 1920, 310 missionaries were sent out, so double the number in 1913. That is a bit of an outlier. It was partly because there had been missionaries who had been delayed by sailing because of the war. Because of the war, and now they're all being sent out in a rush. But throughout the 1920s, the church was sending out more missionaries every year than the total number of missionaries in service in 1897. Every year throughout the 1920s, 150 or more missionaries are going out, new missionaries.
And the outlier year that you just pointed out is a year after the pandemic of 1919.
Right. It's the war and the influenza pandemic.
So despite all of these issues, and perhaps because of them, there was a desire for people to go. They were hindered back, and then over 300.
And actually, even the First World War caused only limited disruption. The Second World War caused a lot more, and we can talk about that in another episode. But the First World War didn't really cause as much disruption as we might think. Spicer told the 1918 General Conference session that in the past 5 years, quote, 542 of our brethren and sisters have gone into the regions beyond, an average well above 100 a year. Wow. And that's during wartime. In the first 20 years after the GC Committee replaced the Foreign Mission Board, so from 1904 to 1924, the Adventist Church sent 2,399 missionaries. Wow. New missionaries sent out. That doesn't include ones who'd been on furlough who returned back to the mission field. 2,399 new missionaries. And by 1930, the total number of new missionaries sent in the first three decades of the century, starting in 1901, was 3,638. So across a 30-year period that includes a war and a pandemic, they're averaging more than 100 new missionaries a year. And most of them remain in service. So you're seeing this extraordinary expansion, and it's because they've got a process in place.
And they don't go for just a year either. So,
no.
You know, you send 100 this year, you send 150 next year. They haven't come back yet, so now you have 250, and then 150 the next year. So simultaneously, they must really have hundreds and hundreds at any given year.
Right. And of course, you start to get people then coming back on furlough after maybe 7 years, 10 years sometimes.
Yeah.
In theory, it was 10, but you get a range of between about 7 and 12 years in practice.
So in some of those years, inevitably, you have more than 1,000 missionaries supported in the field working.
Absolutely. It's extraordinary. And in fact, in the early 20th century, Protestant missionaries worked out what the average support by an American Protestant was in terms of a per capita amount per foreign missionary.
So how many members do you need to have one missionary in the field?
What it was giving. How many cents of the out in a dollar. How many cents does each church member donate each year? Mm-hmm. And these figures were published in missiological journals. Nobody paid attention to the fact that Adventists were actually exceeding those. They were higher than the average American Protestant. The average Adventist contribution of a North American Adventist was higher than the average contribution of all other American Protestants.
That's focus on mission, all right.
Well, and you know, today we know about the 13th Sabbath offering, though even that doesn't get as much attention as it used to, perhaps. There's the 13th Sabbath offering, and we still have, to some extent, the annual week of sacrifice offering. But in the early 20th century, they had 13th Sabbath offering. They had the week of sacrifice offering when people were encouraged and did give a week's salary.
Wow.
Which doesn't happen today with the week of sacrifice offering. But people were giving a week of their salary. They also had what they called Big Week. Big Week was a time when they focused on giving for mission. They also had what started as the 10-cent a week plan, by which a church member would say, I'll pay 10 cents per week to support foreign missions. And as inflation went up, it went up from 10 cents a week to 20 cents a week to 25 cents a week and so forth. And they also had something called the Midsummer Offering, which was used for various purposes, but was often used for mission as well. So the church was incredibly focused on mission, and the result is partly that you get all these missionaries going out because there's such generosity. But without an organizing team, without a control center, even all the funds that come in aren't going to be used appropriately.
No.
And these thousands of missionaries were recruited, processed, sent across the seas, and sustained there by the General Conference Secretariat.
That's beautiful. To what degree, David, were these missionaries sent by the U.S. compared to other parts of the world, sending missionaries to other parts of the world?
All right, so it's a good question. America dominated the number of foreign missionaries sent out until the 1970s.
But so most came from America, yes, although not exclusively.
By no means exclusively. In the early 20th century, German, British, Australian missionaries begin to go out in numbers that, given the number of total number of Adventists, the number of missionaries they're sending out is considerable.
So the ratio is high.
The ratio, yes, if you were to calculate it as the number of missionaries per 1,000 church members, it would be higher than in the United States. But the majority of new missionaries come from the United States because, of course, that's where the majority of the members are. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They are in the United States.
And the other question that came to my mind as you were describing this is the 20s and 30s, you're describing a great period of faithfulness and giving to mission. They weren't the easiest years for the U.S. economy. They were struggling very much during that time.
Absolutely, 100%. So that makes it all the more remarkable.
Today we have seen a decrease in giving to foreign missions. Of course, it's difficult to know why exactly, although you've been doing some research on this, but is your gut feeling that, is it because we are not focused on mission as we were? Is it because we have so many things to focus on and the church has increased its complexity and therefore its operation, and there are now multiple bureaucracies and so on? Yeah. Are people less interested in mission? Do we think that we now finished the work already and we've explored all that we have to? What are your thoughts about that?
I hear North American Adventists saying that. And we've talked about this, I think, once on a previous episode. We love to tell stories of mission success. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why on this podcast we also tell stories of mission disappointment and death and things not going so well. Because the problem we tell stories of success. But when you only tell triumphalist narratives, it's easy to build up the impression that the work is nearly done. And so if you only talk about...
And many evangelists have spoken in those terms, like Jesus is about to come. We are everywhere already. We've finished our mission almost.
Right. And for every Zambia or Zimbabwe, where there's something like 9 to 10% of the population are Adventists, or the Solomon Islands or Vanuatu in the South Pacific, where it's 11% of the population are Adventists, it's close to that it's a high percentage in Jamaica and Papua New Guinea and parts of Central America. But then we can talk about Chad, we can talk about Algeria, we can talk about Egypt, we can even talk about India, where there are several hundred thousand Adventists reported as church members, but you're talking about of more than a billion people. So you're still talking about a mere fraction of the population, and the same is true of China. I think it's a few things. Firstly, there is the growing impression in some parts of the Western world that, hey, the rest of the world is taken care of, and we look around and see post-Christianity and materialism and secularism, and we need to focus our efforts here. And there's no doubt, there's always been a need to focus your efforts on your community around you.
Sure.
We've never said otherwise. But the church in the Western world is still very blessed financially. And the church in North America is large in just in net terms, well over a million members, but it's also well blessed by God in terms of educated, technologically trained missionaries, people who can serve as doctors, as nurses, as teachers.
Yeah.
So
to help not just financially, but resources. And now with the mission refocus, yeah, there are other parts of the world that are equally resourced and are now being encouraged to send their own missionaries and resources there.
Right. And so Brazil, we have a number of universities. We have large numbers of church members. They're materially blessed. And Brazil is sending out missionaries. As I've traveled and as you've traveled for the church, Sam, I think you will have also encountered Filipino missionaries,
everywhere.
Mexican, mm-hmm. Filipino missionaries everywhere. Yes, because we've got a really good education system in the Philippines.
Yes.
And it produces a lot of graduates, Korean missionaries, Mexican missionaries.
Yeah. Even Argentinians once now are expanding to different places.
I have great. Yeah. So, but there is still a need for church members in the Western world to step up in terms of giving, mm-hmm. particularly, but also being willing to serve. So I think it's partly that misconception that the work is nearly done, and it isn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if we convert 100% of the population of Kingston, Jamaica, or Lusaka in Zambia, or Harare in Zimbabwe, if we still have cities of a million or more across the Middle East where there is not a single Adventist. Christ says, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached to all the nations.
Yes.
And then the end will come.
I've had a thought as we talk, because it seems to me that in this part of the of our church history, it was very clear that the mission was to proclaim to every human being alive. So let's go to where human beings are and let's proclaim as fast as we possibly can. In the last few years, there may be an emphasis on church growth more than proclamation.
Yes.
Which does impact how we think of the resources that we have. And if our mission is proclamation, then how can we maximize the proclamation to the unreached places, to the most difficult places in the world? How can we, and proclamation isn't just preaching, obviously. If people are not interested, if you don't care for them in any way, they're not going to be interested in what you have to say at all. In all of the missions that we've had in this period, you always had teachers with doctors, with humanitarians that came along with the Bible, you know, teachers in that mission groups that were sent. So I wonder if our focus on ourselves sometimes comes from this idea that we need to grow instead of we need to reach and proclaim new people.
Right. Yes, we put a premium on numbers, growth in numbers, and therefore quantitative rather than qualitative.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you were to go back and read, as I have, the proceedings of General Conference sessions of the early and mid-20th century, here's the way the divisions that are mission fields in Latin America, Africa, and parts of Asia report. They'll always talk about numbers, but the numbers are always the people left to reach, because the numbers of Adventists are low. And they never talk about the numbers of Adventists we have. Instead, they'll say, yes, we have this many members, but that means we have this many hundred millions of people to reach.
It's very different.
And what they say and what they focus on when they talk about the church members is faithfulness. They don't talk about numbers and success in evangelism. What they talk about is faithfulness. Our church members, the numbers may be small, but they are faithful. Here are these people who suffered because of Sabbath keeping, but they maintained their faith. Here are these people who suffered this, but they maintained their faith and they continued to witness. So it's a qualitative focus. And when they talk about numbers, it's always about what's left to do rather than about, dare I say it, boasting about what has been achieved.
Yeah. Our eschatology does not contemplate us being the largest church in the world. We don't ever imagine that one day Adventism will be so prolific that we will be larger than other denominations.
We'll be a remnant.
Always a remnant that is there to proclaim and to announce and to help people understand that the time is near. There is a point to be made, I think, that when a denomination, when a Christian group reaches a certain size, it is easier, and perhaps there's a temptation to talk about achievements, because you have something to account for and to present. And as I represent the church in various environments, that's often what I talk about. But if you look at, if your mission is to reach 8 billion people, 22 million is nothing.
No.
It is nothing. The mission ahead of us is so absolutely impossible that it will take all of us to invest everything we have, sometimes even going to other places and being missionaries ourselves, other times supporting those missionaries. And we still have not met the new Seventh-day Adventist that will rise to go to those places, because 22 million is impossible. So our mission is, actually, have we counted, compared the population to membership to see if it's getting easier or harder?
No, the ratio of Adventists to population has fallen every year since the 1860s.
So we are progressing toward that.
We are progressing. So we are growing faster than the world's population is growing. So that's
good news.
That's encouraging. That's very encouraging. That's very encouraging. And you know, it does seem impossible, but with it's a cliche, but it's true. With the new types of media that are available, it's possible to reach people in areas where we have no members. Though I still think you'll need to have human contact in order to reach people. You know, just as a pure mathematical projection, if every Adventist church member won one other person to the faith
per year, presumably,
it would take us less than 10 years to reach the world. That's purely a theoretical exercise, because, of course, it's easy in some places, some parts of the world, for one church member to win somebody else. In others, it's
illegal.
It's illegal, and it's incredibly difficult. And so, but still, it's just worth remembering the power of exponential growth. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as impossible as it may seem.
But we need total involvement of everybody.
We need total involvement of everybody. And again, we need a focus to say not on how many have we won, but are we reaching people in those parts of the world that at this moment barely know about Jesus, much less about the Seventh-day Adventist Church?
In this episode, we are not focusing on the missionaries that are sent. We are focusing on the involvement of those that provide the infrastructure, the bureaucracy, and setting up the processes and systems to allow those missionaries to go. How would you rate the importance of this work compared to the risky business of actually going to the mission field?
The risky business is definitely the most important thing. But the two are symbiotic halves. You can't
separate them.
Because there's no point having a smooth, lean administrative machine
with nobody to go.
With nobody to go. And at the moment, we have a very bureaucratic machine that can only send out a few hundred people a year, because we've probably become too bureaucratic. And I say that as a member of the Secretariat, and the GC Secretariat recognizes that and is trying to change to become more agile, more nimble, and quicker to respond. But it's not enough to have a really good administrative machine unless you have people who are willing to go and literally risk their lives, or give their lives, as we discussed last time, giving many years of their lives and foregoing their family connections and so forth. But at the same time, as we've already said, it doesn't matter how many heroic volunteers you have if you don't have a system for sending them and then sustaining them and keeping them in place. And, you know, praise God for Adventists supporting ministries. But there are supporting ministries that have sent missionaries overseas without being properly, fully resourced. And what ends up happening is that the missionaries fall into crisis and the organized church has to bail them out.
And I'm glad we can.
and we do, because they're church members and we're all on the same side. But there is an example that if you're not properly resourced and don't have a really good system behind you, then things do become impossible for the missionaries in the field. So these are two symbiotic halves of the same thing. They both need each other, and without them, we wouldn't have a worldwide missionary enterprise.
Yeah.
That's all we have time for today. Come back next time. We'll continue with the story of how the General Conference Secretariat sustained mission around the world. Thanks again for joining us in this episode. Please keep watching on AdventistReview.tv or on the Seventh-day Adventist Church's YouTube channel, or keep listening on your favorite podcast platform. And if you have enjoyed this episode, please share about it with your friends. If you want to know more about Adventist missionary work and missionaries today, go to AdventistMission.org. That's AdventistMission.org. And if you want to find mission opportunities today for service, go to VividFaith.com. That's VividFaith.com. We'll be back next week with more on the inspiring history of Adventist mission around the world.